This is Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. The Endangered Species Act celebrates its 40th anniversary this year. Throughout its life, the landmark legislation has been a lightning rod, hailed by some as the strongest environmental law we have, decried by others as an impediment to economic growth. So, is the Endangered Species Act doing what it was intended to do? A 2012 study by the Center for Biological Diversity found that while only 1% of the once endangered species have recovered sufficiently to be delisted, 90% of species on the list are recovering at the expected rate. Later this hour, we'll visit an art gallery on Martha's Vineyard that's working with artists, authors, and environmental groups to get people thinking and talking about endangered species.
I wish everybody who had an art gallery would promote something beyond selling art and creating beauty and, you know, paying the bills, because I think it's a great vehicle.
But first, we turn to Dr. Joe Roman for more on the history and effectiveness of the Endangered Species Act. Joe Roman is research assistant professor at the Rubenstein School of Environment and Natural Resources at the University of Vermont and a fellow at the Gund Institute for Ecological Economics. He's also the author of Listed, Dispatches from America's Endangered Species Act, which won the 2012 Rachel Carson Environment Book Award. Joe Roman joins us now by phone from Duke University Marine Lab in North Carolina. Joe, welcome.
Thank you, Heather.
Now, the Endangered Species Act is not really the first of its kind. There were efforts to list and to protect endangered species before the Endangered Species Act went into effect 40 years ago. Why was this particular law so important?
Yeah, so as you had mentioned, in the 1960s, there were lists put together. People were aware that extinction was a problem. It was highlighted in part by work written by Rachel Carson, Silent Spring, in the early 60s, and then efforts to protect wilderness. And these laws were important. They put forward certain protections for species, but the problem was that they were often couched in where practicable, so that it was, if it worked, you know, and usually on national wildlife reserves, that's when you would be protecting species. In 1973, however, everything changed, because the Endangered Species Act said very clearly zero extinction with no exceptions. So that law really changed the playing field for how conservation took place in the United States, with great ramifications both on federal lands as well as on private lands.
How many species are there on the list at this point?
Right now, there are a few more than 2,000, and I think it's 2050. 1,400 of those are found in the United States, and the rest of them are protected in other countries, in Africa, for example, or in Australia.
So how does that work with a federal law in the U.S. protecting species from outside our lands?
It's been effective early on. Some of the first species that were added to the list after the law was passed were actually a bunch of kangaroos. And that gave Australia some leverage to start protecting their local wildlife. What it means practically for Americans, though, it limits the transport of these animals into or out of the United States, so that if they're protected as endangered species, you'd need specific permits to trade in them. So you can't go out and kill them and bring in, for example, rhino horns or other or elephant tusks into the United States.
Now, when we think about endangered species, we tend to think about plants or animals. Those are both covered by the Endangered Species Act. What about microbes?
Yeah, microbes are not protected. There's no doubt that we're gaining and losing microbial species all the time, but to date, we haven't gotten there yet. For my book, I went to Yellowstone, where there are some fascinating microbes that have been used in biotechnology. And, you know, of course, Yellowstone's protected, and other areas around the world are, but there are lots of places that are changing all the time. One best we can do to hope is that they're evolving fast enough that we're not losing a lot of microbial diversity, but that's a new frontier for us, really.
Well, I mean, as you kind of alluded to there, environments are constantly changing. Extinction is a natural part of evolution. This zero tolerance policy, does that really take that into account? Or, you know, are these all cases where humans are the cause of the potential extinction?
That's right. So the background rate of extinctions, let's say about one species out of a million every year or so, but we're seeing right now much higher rates of extinction, where we're seeing maybe 10, 100, even 1,000 times higher than the background rate we're seeing these extinctions. So many biologists think we're in a sixth mass extinction, and we're causing it. Humans are causing that. Sure, there may be some natural extinctions, but the overwhelming majority, more than 99% of the extinctions, are caused by habitat changes or overharvest or the introduction of invasive species, so that really any time we're trying to prevent an extinction, it's almost certainly an anthropogenic extinction that we're worried about.
Now, you have said that large mammals are particularly vulnerable and make up a disproportionate number of the species on the endangered species list. Why is that?
Well, one is that they are large, so they require large ranges, and therefore we start, as we're developing land, we start moving in on their land so they can reduce their range, but also large animals are often hunted. So you can think of elephants, you can think of whales, we can think of a lot of the large predators out there, for example, wolves, which were extirpated through most of the lower 48 in the 20th century. So a lot of these species are either persecuted or because of their life histories, they also are slow to breed, so it takes them several years in order to have offspring. All of these characteristics put them at greater risk than, for example, microbes, as you mentioned, which could turn over, you know, generations many times in a year or sometimes even several times in a week or a day.
Now, I think it's interesting to look at how much cultural values have shifted. 40 years in our individual lifetime may seem like a long time, but in terms of cultural shifts, it's not really that long. And to think back to 1973, it really took some work to get even things like whales, which we now think of many of our large whales as just, you know, national treasures, but it really took some work to even get them put onto the endangered species list.
That's right. And I spoke to Lee Talbot, who was working in the Nixon White House in the late 60s and early 70s, and he told me that at the time, you know, just this was really what prompted the Endangered Species Act. In part was the fact was that there were great whales were still being hunted for the oil that was being used as a lubricant on submarines and on jets. So the military, the Defense Department, as well as the Commerce Department, did not want to list these species because they felt like they were dependent on the products that came from these animals. It was clear, though, biologically, that the numbers were declining very quickly. Lee Talbot met with DuPont and got an affidavit saying that they could create an artificial lubricant, which would allow the Defense Department to still maintain, of course, its jets and its ships, and also allow the Interior Department to list these whales. He met with the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the Nixon White House in the early 1970s, and they agreed to withhold their objections to that listing. And all of a sudden, we started seeing a lot of environmental protection for these species once that was listed. But keep in mind that I think extinction also started to change people's minds. Once they saw that great whales were no longer innumerable, that they could that the numbers could decline, we saw a lot of species looking like they could go extinct, that started to change people's minds as well. So we stopped using harpoons, and now the way we interact with whales, as you know, off the Cape Cod, is by going out and watching them, is really the economic activity that these whales bring about.
Well, one whale, I believe it's the gray whale, actually has recovered to the point that under the Endangered Species Act, it could actually be delisted. But of course, whales also are kind of doubly protected. They also have the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which is this very blanket protection that protects them on the basis of some, I guess, intrinsic value that we place on marine mammals, whether or not they're endangered.
That's right. And so gray whales were delisted in 1994. They were considered recovered, and there are now tens of thousands of gray whales in the Pacific. And so we've certainly seen protections working for a lot of whale species, including humpbacks, are doing fabulously well. Right whales, especially off the coast of Massachusetts, not so well. There's still only a couple of hundred of those individuals, but we have seen both the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which isn't just about preventing extinction, but the Marine Mammal Protection Act, that goal is to bring populations up to ecological, where they're the historic ecological role in the oceans, which is really an admirable goal. That is, restore those populations to the numbers where they'd be important members in the food web and in the cycles that are happening out in the oceans.
So then what is the difference between the definition of recovered under the Endangered Species Act and bringing a population back to an ecologically functional level?
Yeah, well, that has been a challenge. So one is that we're going to have you're going to look at the amount of take or the amount of individuals, for example, in marine mammal populations that are they being removed at a greater rate than the populations able to sustain itself or rebuild itself, and that's a concern if we see those takes or those reductions hitting these individual species at a high rate. Then you're going to have some recovery or management plan. As far as the Endangered Species Act goes, what you're concerned out there is it likely to become extinct in the near future? Is it endangered with extinction? And if it's not, if it's considered safe, then the species is can be removed. Think of the bald eagle, a great success story. Peregrine falcons in the East Coast, another great success story. Or alligators, even. It's amazing to think that alligator populations, once in the 1970s when they were heavily harvested, you wouldn't even see alligators in Florida or Louisiana. Anyone that's visited now, it's hard to imagine that because you see them almost everywhere.
But so you're saying there's basically this middle ground between truly healthy and just no longer endangered.
That's right. So, So truly healthy, or are they playing an ecological, are they ecologically sustainable? Are they playing an ecological role? And whether they're safe from extinction, there's a big difference between those two. Biologists, ecologists, the goal is to have those optimum populations so that they are playing an active role in the ecosystem. But the Endangered Species Act is more concerned with really trying to prevent the permanent loss of these species.
Well, so there are three ways, actually, to get off the endangered species list. One is to be recovered. Mm-hmm. One is the exact opposite, to go extinct.
Right. And
then in the middle somewhere, there's this category where if biologists change their mind about what a species mm-hmm. is, I guess, to reclassify a species, obviously right. that could potentially get it off the list. And this, for me anyway, brings to mind kind of a win-loss tie situation. Do we have a win-loss tie record for the Endangered Species Act?
Oh, well, so there are some, the estimates are, I don't know about win-loss, so let's look at it another way. How many species are improving? So about 10% of the species are now improving that are protected. About a third are stable. A third, and this is worrisome, are declining, and about 25% we're not really sure. That is, we don't have the data for it. So if you're looking at the glass half full, you're saying, well, you only got 10% are improving. It's not doing well. If you're looking at the glass half empty, you're saying, well, look, we won, as you had said, with the Center for Biological Diversity report. We prevented the extinction of, let's say, 99% of the species that are on the list have not gone extinct. And also, we're improving most of the species that we know about. So there, that's the broad numbers. But we also know that a couple of dozen species have gone extinct while waiting to be listed on the Endangered Species Act, and a few dozen have recovered and been removed from that act. Keep in mind, these are slow processes. These take a long time in order to recover these species, so it's not going to happen overnight.
Well, from a scientific perspective, and this was kind of the goal when you set out to write Listed, was to evaluate the Endangered Species Act effectiveness to some degree. Is the Endangered Species Act working? Is it slowing extinctions?
Yes, it absolutely is slowing extinction. Some studies have shown that we would have expected, given the rate of extinction before the act had been put into place, if that rate were to have continued, we would have lost several hundred species. More than 300 species would have disappeared. Over that time period, that study was done over about 30 years, we lost about 30 species. So, that's 30 species too many, 30 species or populations too many, but it's reduced the extinction rate by as much as 90%. I mean, this is really an effective legislation. Now, of course, the legislation as written is very powerful, but there are always, you know, that not it's not always enforced as well as it could be, or there are political complications. So we don't win every battle, but the goal is to really take extinction, make extinction unacceptable.
Now, obviously, it takes money to do this. How much do we spend on trying to prevent extinction?
Yeah. So right now, the federal government and all the states, that's the only tally I have, it's about $1.5 billion a year. So it's all the federal and state money they're spent to protect species. Clearly, I think most ecologists, most conservation biologists think that's not enough. That is, it's barely enough. A lot of their high-profile species, salmon, for example, stellar sea lions, that get a lot of money, get hundreds of millions of dollars. We care about them. They're food fish, or they might impact our food, or we like them because they're lovable, because they're cute. But a lot of species get maybe $50,000 a year, barely enough to write the report that says that we don't really know a lot about what's going on in those populations. So I think that would be the biggest thing we could do besides improve enforcement is to increase the funding for this act.
I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with conservation biologist and author Joe Roman about the Endangered Species Act, which marks its 40th anniversary this year. Now, Joe, before the break, we were talking a little bit about the economics of the Endangered Species Act, how much money is spent on trying to preserve endangered species. And of course, when the act first went into place, as you've also alluded to, it was a very powerful language that said essentially at any cost we need to stop extinction. But that language was toned down over time, in part because of one very controversial early case, the snail darter. Can you tell us a little bit about the story of the snail darter?
Sure. I mean, keep in mind that when the act passed, it was supported overwhelmingly in the Senate, 92 to nothing. This included supporters. The supporters included Republicans like Bob Dole of Kansas, Jesse Helms of North Carolina, and Ted Stevens of Alaska. Also, and this is important, Howard Baker of Tennessee. Now, so everyone, it was overwhelmingly supported both in the Senate and the House and signed by Nixon. And I think most people thought there were a couple of hundred or species on the list. Many people probably thought that the numbers would go down over time. We'd remove the threats and then take them off the list. But what soon became apparent a couple of years after the act was passed, that there were lots of species, small species, that were in need of protection. And one of those was discovered by David Ettinger on the Little Tennessee River. It was the snail darter. He discovered it just before a dam was going to be completed by the Tellico Dam by the Tennessee Valley Authority.
And the snail darter is a small fish, right?
The snail darter is a small fish, that's right. Ettinger was an ichthyologist based at the University of Tennessee. And so he discovers this fish, and the dam is just about completed. So he brings that. He brings that to local environmental groups, and it goes from local courts all the way up to the Supreme Court. The decision is okay. The ESA, the Endangered Species Act, says, you know, we have to protect these species, as you had said, without exception. And the local authority, the Tennessee Valley Authority, said, no, this dam is almost done. It's too late to make these changes. The Supreme Court looked at the law and considered the arguments. Zig Plater was one of the lawyers for the snail darter at that time, and decided that the law was clear and that there were no exceptions and the dam would have to be stopped. This made a lot of local Tennessee politicians very upset, and they tried to change the laws in the Senate and in the House, and they got it passed on a late night rider in the House. By the way, Al Gore voted for the dam, and Newt Gingrich voted for the fish at that time. He voted for the darter.
Not a situation we'd expect to see today.
That's right. You wouldn't expect that today. And the dam won. They, even though, despite the Supreme Court's ruling, the dam was completed, and Jimmy Carter threatened to veto it, but he let it go. And the dam was completed, and the snail darter went extinct on the Little Tennessee.
Well, the species did not go completely extinct, though,
that's
correct?
Right. That's right. It was translocated to some nearby rivers, and they did find another population on another river. So it actually now is no longer endangered. It's threatened. It's doing a little bit better, in part, I think, because they took some of the fish from the Little Tennessee and put it in, around other dams where the TVA took a black eye for this. Because it wasn't just about the fish, and here's where the economics comes in. It was also about the farmers who had land along Little Tennessee. They lost their land through eminent domain, and the TVA could resell now waterfront property there. It was about the fishing areas that disappeared in that area as well. It was a well-known area for recreational fishing. So it was more than the fish. The TVA, after this, never built another dam. And now the story about dams, by the way, is we're starting to take them down. We're taking them down in New England, in Maine. We're taking them down in the Chesapeake. We're taking them down the Pacific Northwest. This is going to be great for fish. This is going to be great for people who live along those river systems. So that was the first flashpoint, as you had mentioned. But keep in mind that after that, you know, that we lost that battle. But the war over the dams, I think, has really shifted since that time.
Well, and of course, this snail darter story, which went on for years, raised a lot of questions about, you know, the language in the Endangered Species Act and the goals of it. It was almost maybe simplistic in its original form to just say zero tolerance for extinction, and raised some of these issues like, are we trying to protect every population of a species or just the species as a whole? Or, you know, can we get away with that? And I wonder what the importance of going one way or the other on this population versus whole species question. What's the importance of preserving perhaps one particular population of a species?
Sure. So that's very important. There's been several studies showing, of course, when you lose populations, that leads to extinction. It's not surprising, right? I mean, if you lose several populations that exist, they have some connection, though they exist separately. They're called metapopulations. So if you lose one population, two populations, you can lose the entire species. Several studies have shown that the real extinction crisis that's going on, or the real crisis in biodiversity, is the loss of healthy populations around the world. It's not necessarily only the species, though that gets the high-profile studies. So I think the ESA, those who wrote the Endangered Species Act early on, by focusing on populations, and this is true for the Marine Mammal Protection Act as well, were really visionary in that way, because we need to protect populations, and we need to have them. Plus, we want to restore these species in areas where we people can see them where they were historically. There is some balance. We're not going to protect every individual, that's for sure. But we can protect healthy populations throughout what the Endangered Species Act said, a significant portion of their range. That is a large part of their historical range.
Well, and of course, when you protect any particular population or even an entire species, kind of a side effect of that often is that you end up protecting an entire ecosystem that goes along with that species.
That's exactly right. So what the Endangered Species Act has become is our strongest ecosystem protection act, or our strongest habitat protection act. And this was even recognized by Warren Berger when that argument over the darter got all the way to the Supreme Court. He said that he felt like the lawyers and those who were arguing for the darter really were concerned about the habitat, and they were using the darter as a handy handle, was his term, to protect what they, you know, the river system that they loved. And I think that's true. You know, it is about the habitat, and that's why I would argue that by protecting species, we're protecting habitats, and we're protecting all the ecosystem services that these habitats provide to humans.
Explain a little bit more about what you mean by ecosystem services.
Sure. Let's think of a good example. Trees, they can clean the air. Rivers provide fresh water. Marshlands and barrier beaches along the Cape, for example, they can protect people from extreme events like storms and hurricanes. These are examples of services that nature provides for free. Another way to phrase it is natural capital. By protecting nature, we are getting an immense amount of riches coming to us. That includes those services, but also the intrinsic value, the value that we get as being stewards to the land or to the oceans, and also just having these species to continue to exist.
Now, there have been efforts, of course, to put dollar figures on some of these, as you call them, intrinsic values and ecosystem services. But, of course, one of the remaining controversies, the perennial controversies surrounding the Endangered Species Act, is whether or not it is an unacceptable impediment to growth and development, to jobs, and to these very tangible aspects of our economy. So how do we weigh those two against each other? Are we making progress on starting to incorporate the, you know, ecosystem services and the intangible economics of ecology into our standard economic system?
Well, we are. Some of them are intangible. For example, you're looking at the existence value, or these are, you know, non-instrumental. These are not things that we can quantify. But there are also very tangible, quantifiable benefits. Think about whale watching. You wouldn't have whale watching without whales. On Stellwagen Bank alone off of Massachusetts, it's valued at $101 million a year. That's, you know, so all the landings of commercial fisheries in Massachusetts is more than that, about $478 million, but $100 million is significant. We can also look at the revenue from marine environmental organizations there. How much do people pay to preserve the marine environment? And again, you're getting hundreds of millions of dollars that people pay to protect the environment. And this goes for steward. This money goes to jobs. This money goes to people that are working around those systems, to infrastructure as well. So we can quantify these, and we do. And it's important, I think, that we do. Conservationists are divided whether it's a good idea. Some are concerned you're always going to lose. People are still going to, you know, if you can sell the tree, chop it down, or you're going to value it to clean your air, you're going to want that initial spurt in cash. But I think it's important to bring these numbers to the table, to look at that, and it allows people to look at the trade-offs. Well, from my view, I think that it's pretty clear that that by protecting ecosystems, it's the only way we're going to have any economy at all, because we depend on these ecosystems.
Well, and you say it's kind of controversial trying to put a value on a species that kind of coming out of, you know, we've had the civil rights movement, the women rights movement, the gay rights movement, and now we're kind of seeing something come out of this, the species rights movement, or mm-hmm. trying to respect other species the way that we try to respect each other as human beings. And some within the species rights movement would say, well, when we put a dollar figure on the life of any given species, you know, we know how hard it is to put a dollar figure on a human life. That seems right. Very cheapening. Are we doing that same thing to species when we try to fit them into this box of a dollar figure?
Well, here's the good news. The answer is no, because the Endangered Species Act is clear. You could put a price on the habitat that you're going to protect, and you can discuss how you're going to what a price on the recovery, but there's no price tag on the animal. We're not saying that a humpback whale is more valuable than a mussel in Apalachicola. Both of those have the right to exist, and the U.S. government, the Endangered Species Act is dedicated to preserving the lives of those species in perpetuity. So we're not putting a dollar value on the particular animal, but what we are doing is looking at the services that are provided by the habitats and, in some cases, individual species. But we're not, I mean, you know, we may do that as people every day. You know, we may value a panda bear, for example, over a frog, but the ESA does not do that. It does not put a price tag on the individual animal. And I think that was wisely done in that sense.
Now, the causes of species being threatened with extinction have changed a bit over the 40 years of the Endangered Species Act. It was, as you said, originally kind of put into place thinking about species that were endangered perhaps because of hunting or harvesting. It's increasingly had to deal with the issue of habitat destruction. But now we're also seeing climate change, this very global amorphous problem, being the cause of extinction or threatening of extinction for many of these species. Is the Endangered Species Act set up to handle that kind of threat?
I think, again, that probably conservationists are divided on this. Clearly, you're seeing some organizations, the polar bear is a good example, wanting to get species that are listed because they are going to be affected by climate change, and polar bear and many other species, Pacific walrus, this is going to be true. We're going to see more and more species that are going to be impacted by climate change in the coming years. Does the ESA, is it going to be the right vehicle to protect, to prevent climate change? This is my personal opinion. I don't think so. I think it's one tool in the toolbox, and I think it's important to use, but we really need strong climate legislation. That's going to be the best way to protect the Earth from climate change. And, of course, as we know, climate change is going to affect animals and plants, but it's also going to affect people and agriculture and everything that we do. So just as we see that when we lose species, it can affect human health or human well-being. We also see that, of course, climate change is going to affect species, but it's going to especially affect humans as well.
Well, you've written before that you think, especially in facing the challenge of climate change, that it's going to be important, increasingly important, to develop cooperative relationships, human communities, and also cooperative relationships between humans and other species. Why does that help us face climate change?
Well, because I think maybe when the Endangered Species Act was first passed, some thought that the way to protect species would be, okay, we have parks, we have refuges, as long as we have them protected there, we're fine and we can do what we want outside of those areas. It's becoming increasingly clear that when we want to manage the planet and also our local areas, that we want to work with species. That is, we want to have, for example, along the coastlines, you're going to need those natural buffers, those marshlands, and those areas that are important for fisheries and for rare and endangered species. You want to have those there, or those areas are going to be increasingly at risk to climate change. So by interweaving wild lands with human landscapes, it really can be a win-win situation.
So it's a matter of more integrating ourselves into our environment, essentially.
That's right. And, you know, keep in mind also that there are several studies showing that by having more wildlife, more diversity, it decreases diseases, zoonotic diseases that can be transmitted by mosquitoes or ticks. Lyme disease is one example, West Nile virus. By having a diversity of species, that will reduce the transmission of disease as well. So you've got both a buffer against major storm events, climate change, as well as diseases.
Dr. Joe Roman is research assistant professor at the Rubenstein School of Environment and Natural Resources at University of Vermont, a fellow at the Gund Institute for Ecological Economics, and author of Listed, Dispatches from America's Endangered Species Act. Joe Roman, thank you.
Thank you, Heather.
We're talking this hour about the Endangered Species Act. The landmark legislation celebrates its 40th anniversary this year. Gay Head Gallery on Martha's Vineyard is running an exhibit to mark the occasion. I got a sneak peek of the exhibit from owner Megan Sargent.
So we're standing here in the entryway, essentially, and you've chosen to feature two animals primarily for the show, the gray wolf and the North Atlantic right whale. And there are, on either side of this wall that you walk in facing, essentially a portrait of each of those species. But much of the artwork that's out here has no animals in it at all. It's water, it's landscapes. It seems like it's setting a mood almost for the entire show that isn't necessarily entirely about these animals.
Well put. Thank you. Would you write that down? We do hope to curate this show and have a little bit of written text on the walls, but that was exactly our intention, was to set a tone and to show that, yes, we're concerned about these individual species, but they live within particular habitats. They're part of a larger ecosystem. There's an interdependence that we all recognize, yet at the same time, we may not think about it as much as we could, especially when it comes to government policy and when it comes to our own simple actions. So yeah, we have this beautiful pastel by Zaria Foreman that's of sky and sea, and it's pinned on the wall. It actually doesn't even have
a
frame.
It's totally unframed. It's just, again, it's that kind of informal feeling.
And it's that, you know, everything is precious, but everything, dust is to dust. And we can enjoy it, but it's going to change because things do change. The other images are really of local landscape. You know, there's one beautiful painting by Liz Taft, where Noman's Island is in the distance, and it's overlooking Moship Trail, which is a very important conservation area in the town of Aquinnah. It's an ongoing conservation effort to protect globally rare coastal heathland habitat. And that's part of what the gallery is trying to help people see, is we can be concerned about Moship Trail Project in Aquinnah, and we can support nonprofits that are doing the trench work.
Let's head in here. As we said, there are two kind of stars of the show, the gray wolf and the North Atlantic right whale. But sitting on the couch here in this living room gallery, we are surrounded by lobsters and seals and birds, works of art that are woodblocks and paintings and sketches. I mean, so many different media. How many different artists do you have in this show, and how did you select the artwork that went into it?
Well, the featured artists, there are two featured artists. That would be Joel Sartori, the main photographer, and he is an award-winning National Geographic photographer, and he's what I would call a portraitist. You'll notice there's some smaller photographs with black backgrounds. There's one of an endangered turtle, several of wolves. There's a roseate tern with a blue background, and then this plover up here. And then there are the aerials, which are more about the context and the environment. If you look at the three over here, there are two aerials of wolves, and then in the middle are the elk. And there's a story there, you know. They're all connected. They all need vast areas of land. They need each other. And I could go into more scientific habitat stuff, but let me go speak to the other featured artist, and that is Matthew Smith. And he is responsible for the copper plate etchings and the wood blocks. And you'll see several turtles. There's some wood blocks of right whales, a very realistic right whale over the mantle. He was a commercial deep sea fisherman and really knew where to go with, I don't know how big a fleet he worked with, but he was really a hunter and an explorer and very deft at creating technology to catch fish. And over time, what I gather is he was so disturbed by the entanglements that he saw of whales and the waste with bycatch that he gave it up and started to pursue his talent as an artist. I didn't know he's actually had some changes with his business, and he didn't have a framer, and he knew the show was coming up. And I said, well, really, the focus is on endangered species. This is really celebrating the 40th anniversary of this Endangered Species Act, and it's about talking to the public about different proposals that are perhaps undermining key species. And in the case, as you've noted, the wolf and the right whale. And he said, well, I don't have many more whales, but you have a few, but let's see what I have for endangered species. Oh, well, I have this turtle, I have that turtle. Oh, and I have the plover, and I have anyone on. And he had such an array of amazing, the bluefin tuna, creatures that are under great threat. And clearly, the fact that he chooses to do art of them tells you how he shares the same motivation that, you know, that we have here at the gallery to connect people.
How often is that the case? I mean, you do shows on an array of issues. Do your artists usually share your conservation mission? Is that something that you look for in the artists that you include?
Pretty much anyone in this gallery has a conservation mission. They are connected to the gallery because they agree, yes, this is something that might work. We might be able, through art, to connect people, to get more engaged in doing sustainable practices in their own backyard or contacting a representative because they're taking a certain stand on an issue.
How specific is your mission when you do these kinds of shows, and how much action are you trying to get people to take? You know, do you want people to be signing a petition for a particular action with regard to the gray wolf, or is it simply that you want them to become more aware and more involved, to come to their own conclusions and take action in their own form?
In the case of the show that's opening on the 24th, we will have information for people so that they can comment on the proposal to delist the wolf. Really, what motivated this show was the delisting proposal. I think of my motivation with the gallery to connect people to probably policy more than science, but science is so a part of the policy side of things. And if you can help people to understand that, then they will be more open-minded, perhaps less hysterical about, oh, there's evidence perhaps of a coyote on the vineyard. Does that mean that my child is at risk or my cat is at risk? And if they actually hear the science behind the fact that there probably wouldn't be enough coyotes to threaten anybody but a few bunny rabbits and maybe some rare ground birds, they wouldn't be so quick to want to eliminate them.
There are limitations to what science can tell us or how science can inform policy, right? The whole point of science is to try to be objective and give us the facts. And then obviously policy has to take into account some value judgments, ethics or morals or cultural values. Art is inherently not objective. It's inherently a subjective interpretation of the world. Do you think that there is a disconnect there between trying to use art, the subjective means, to connect people? You say you're trying to connect them more to policy, but through that science, is there any tension there between those two?
It's definitely subjective, but there's definitely formal criteria to assess whether some art is better than other art, whether you're going to talk from a Jungian standpoint, you know, where we have these icons that we just relate to. So there I am. I guess I'm bringing up a deeper level than the term subjective. I think we connect with wildlife when we are presented with our pet or we see a deer. Something happens to a lot of us where we feel really good, really inspired, really in awe. I think art can do that as well. When you have someone come into an art gallery and it's not an art gallery full of work that is realistic and representational, which I think you can pretty much look around and say, yeah, there's some photographs and they're of something real, but they're not calendar photographs of a landscape. They're a little provocative. They're a little edgy. When people relate to that, then I know I've got them.
Why was it important to you to open a gallery with a mission? And is that a model that you've encountered somewhere else, or was it an idea that simply came to you?
No, I'd never known of anyone who has tried to do this. Why I decided to do it is I'd had the gallery with my husband for over a decade, and the gallery closed in 2000. And I was involved with lots of different things, including a lot of conservation work, as well as working on I was served on the Martha's Vineyard Commission. I was involved with land use planning and was developing a keener and keener interest in policy issues. And I realized that the gallery is sort of automatic for me. I have established a base. I do it without thinking too hard. It's a lot of work, but I know how to do that. Is there a way to integrate that with my passion? And my passion is inspiring people to be concerned about the environment and to be concerned about community and to be engaged in our civil society so that it will be a civil society. So it's really very much something that just evolved, and it's still evolving. I have visions of an internet presence. Ultimately, what I want to see is a website that's connected to this sense of place, which is the gallery here on Martha's Vineyard in Aquinnah. But I want to create a place for people to go through the website where they see a beautiful work of art with a title and credit to the artist, but there's perhaps a provocative statement that points them in the direction of an environmental organization that's advocating, or it could even be, you know, a communal weaver in Africa. You know, I don't think it has to be limited to the environment, but it's taking something and then leading people to another place and to resources, and just piquing their interest a little bit more blatantly by giving them the resource at their fingertips.
So what is your relationship between the gallery and the nonprofits that you work with on these shows?
We feature nonprofits by curating shows that, in the case of our focus now, educate our visitor to complex environmental issues and concerns. And it doesn't necessarily mean we curate with lots of written text. We curate with an intention so that when we talk to our clientele, they can learn what some of these issues are. And we, of course, have written material usually offered by the nonprofit. So the point is that the exhibit is ultimately promoting the nonprofit so that the public learns what the nonprofit is all about.
Do you know what your next exhibit will be?
I really would love to do a show on pollinators.
Yeah, the colony collapse disorder of the bees and the lack of bees is a hot issue.
It's a hot issue, and just thinking of it from the standpoint of the beauty of what sort of artwork I could have in the gallery. That's sort of the fun of doing this is I have an artist who does beautiful florals, but it's just not going to fit into the endangered species show. So what can I do to bring that in and still promote some of the information that I want people to get a handle on? So with pollinators, it would be flowers, insects. We would go into farming. We would go into the issues around colony collapse. We would talk about displacement of native species. I'd like to try to do it a little differently, where it's not quite as formal. It's a little more intimate. We can have a conversation and connect people to resources. That's part of, I think, your first question, which I've gone on several tangents, I'm sure, is what is my goal? Is it for people to sign petitions, to take actions? Yes, that's great. That's ultimately my goal. But it's really to help people access resources.
Megan Sargent, thank you.
Thank you, Heather Goldstone. This was an absolute pleasure. Thanks for coming all the way to Aquinnah to Gayhead Gallery.
My pleasure.
Our show last week on marine robotics prompted some of you to get in touch. Julia writes, "One request I'd like to make is to stop calling vehicles like Alvin manned. We all know that women routinely occupy and use Alvin, and that there has been a female Alvin pilot. The more accepted term now is HOV, human occupied vehicles. Seems kind of picky, but it's an important distinction." And Amy took issue with our description of autonomous underwater vehicles. AUVs can mow the lawn and cover large areas very quickly, she says. Calling it very boring insinuates it's easy and not important, not such an intelligent answers. AUVs can think on their own. That's what we work on in our lab. If you have thoughts or ideas to share with us, you can send us an email, livinglabradio@wgbh.org, or you can find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or Twitter. Until next week, this is Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support from Michael and Roxanne Zach. Living Lab is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.